Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adnan Rashid, a leader of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, who explains why he and other union activists oppose the ongoing U.S. military occupation of his country. Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses growing opposition to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq and plans for a large anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. this September. And Chris Levin, of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who considers what's at stake for workers as the U.S. Congress debates ratification of the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Interpress Service reports that four investigators from the United Nations Human Rights Commission are seeking to visit the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The group is looking to investigate allegations of torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of the detainees, officially called enemy combatants by the U.S. government. The U.N. body also wants to look into alleged violations of the right to health and the right to due process. The investigators plan to submit a full report to the U.N. Human Rights Commission at its next full session in Geneva in the spring of 2006. The U.N. investigators have not yet received a reply from the Bush administration on their request to visit Guantanamo Bay. Amnesty International has called the facility the gulag of our time. Former Presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton have called for the closure of the detention center. The 500 detainees held in Guantanamo Bay have not been charged with any offense and are not recognized as prisoners of war. UN human rights investigator Paul Hunt of New Zealand says there are real concerns about the mental health condition of detainees at the facility, including reports of dozens of suicide attempts and tactics used like sleep deprivation. Hunt adds that a visit to Guantanamo is critical to finding out what the true conditions are at the prison. The Los Angeles Times reports that a decision by the CIA to fly Sudan's intelligence chief, Major General Salah Abdullah Gash, to Washington, D.C. for secret meetings met with strong resistance. Gash, who had allowed the CIA to question al-Qaeda suspects in Sudan, has been accused by human rights activists of being the chief planner for the wave of political violence in Darfur, which former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell condemned as genocide. Sudan remains on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. In late June, members of the Congressional Black Caucus sharply criticized the visit in a meeting with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Human rights activists have criticized the Bush administration for remaining silent on the atrocities in Darfur while increasing intelligence cooperation with Sudan. New Jersey Congressman Don Payne compared the visit by Gash to inviting the head of the Nazi SS at the height of the Holocaust. Virginia Republican Representative Frank Wolf said, "This sends a very bad signal. Unless he's providing information that is going to save the Western world, it's hard to see how you can justify this." United Airlines bailed out on its union workforce in mid-May when a federal court allowed the airline to turn over its pension fund to the government-run Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The Public Pension Board is left with responsibility to pay $9.8 billion in pension liabilities, the largest pension failure in 30 years. The deal could lead to more pension plan failures. It is also coming at the time when President George Bush continues to push for private accounts for Social Security. According to the news magazine In These Times, the survival of the pension plan is a huge issue for working Americans. More Americans rely on pension benefits than on Social Security for the bulk of their retirement income. Now, United joins 9,000 other pension plans that have been canceled since 2000. Over the last 4 years, the pension board has assumed the pension liabilities of 175,000 workers a year. Other big companies like Delta, Continental, and Greyhound are now thinking about scrapping their pension plans. All the new pension liabilities may force the public pension board into bankruptcy. It is currently responsible for $62 billion in pension payments, but only has $39 billion in hard assets. Taxpayers may be forced to pay the difference. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
A network of more than 100 national, regional, and local groups called U.S. Labor Against the War sponsored the first ever U.S. tour of Iraqi labor activists in June. Six representatives of three Iraqi labor federations visited 20 American cities with the goal of educating U.S. trade unionists about the conditions faced by Iraqi workers and their struggle to build direct worker-to-worker, union-to-union solidarity. The three federations represent a broad spectrum of the Iraqi labor movement, but all call for the withdrawal of U.S. and British occupation forces, and all are working to build a democratic, secular society in Iraq. Adnan Rashid, a mechanic and a leader of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, spoke in Hartford, Connecticut on June 22nd at the state headquarters of the Service Employees International Union, 1199. While stating that repression of labor was at its worst under Saddam Hussein, Rashid describes how U.S. military forces occupied his union offices for 8 months last year, evidence, he says, that repression of unions continues. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rashid through a translator. He discusses the history of repression, current economic conditions, and the support that Iraqi union activists seek from their brothers and sisters in the U.S. labor movement.
The unions in Iraq have a history of about 80 years, and I've never seen a worse period in history than I have seen under Saddam Hussein. There were 12 federations of unions, and Saddam Hussein canceled six of them, and they were down to six federations. And the ones that he canceled are basically the public unions and left only the private sector, and the public union. Public labor force is, of course, the larger and more important labor force than the one that reflects public.
Were you glad to see Saddam Hussein overthrown by U.S. forces?
The removal of Saddam Hussein for us is an important nationalistic goal that was accomplished. And this removal of Saddam Hussein was helpful for ending a repression of the public in Iraq that has suffered significantly under his rule. If the change had happened through the Iraqi public in action, it would have been much, much more truthful to the nature of Iraq and to its interests if it had happened naturally and endogenously within Iraq rather than by external forces.
Do you support the occupation presently?
We do not support the occupation. We've never supported the occupation because it is an invasion of our country that had no reason and no justification.
Now, I'd like to know a little bit about what the situation is right now in Iraq with the U.S. occupation.
Our biggest concern is the economic situation, which has deteriorated rapidly under the current administration. And we hope that there will be change in the economy such that we will reopen a lot of the worker force and allow more workers into the labor force. Most projects in Iraq now actually employ half or less than half of the number of people that they could employ, and the production in Iraq is half of what it could be if the situation was changed. Another problem and obstacles to our progress has been the lack of electricity and water that's under the current administration and security, which results in the both private and public sector workforce not being able to be as productive as it could be otherwise. And another problem that we face is this open borders to products and services from abroad, where many people are coming from abroad, and this affects local industries and local workforce and prevents them from developing fully locally. Examples of this are like most of the clothes factories and so forth in Iraq are not functioning because of ready-made clothes coming from all over the world, the same with refrigerators and other products that are now flooding into Iraq, where the average Iraqi cannot afford them, but also the average Iraqi is not working to be able to afford them.
What about privatization? Has there been much privatization so far under the American occupation?
We believe that privatization is very harmful to the Iraqi public in this stage of the game. We think that privatization is especially harmful when it deals with oil and public services such as health and education and so forth. So privatization is being prepared and being talked about, especially in line with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund coming into Iraq to provide loans conditional on privatization of these things like oil and other important sectors. In addition, there are about $18 billion that we heard of that various countries are supposed to donate to Iraq. Many of them may be conditional on being spent to private sector rather than public sector services. Yeah, most of these are programs that have not been implemented yet, awaiting basically an appointment of a new government that is supposed to be happening this year with the new constitution, and then privatization will kick in after that. That's at least what we hear is being planned.
You think that things wouldn't be any worse than they are now with the occupation if it were to end?
On the contrary, we believe the continuation of the occupation is what leads to further violence, and that there are many people who justify violence based on the presence of the occupation. So we have our own institutions that can take care of our own problems subsequent to the end of the occupation, but the occupation is certainly not helpful in this regard.
And what do you want the U.S. labor movement to do to support the labor movement in Iraq?
We hope that they would help us end the occupation as soon as possible, and upon end the occupation, that they would help us rebuild Iraq and the infrastructure of Iraq, which was devastated by this war.
That was Adnan Rashid of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, who just completed a speaking tour of the United States. Translation was provided by Mazin Kumsia. Contact the sponsoring organization, U.S. Labor Against the War, by visiting their website at www.uslaboragainstwar.org. Recent public opinion polls indicate that increasing numbers of Americans now oppose the Bush administration's decision to launch the Iraq War and the continuing bloody occupation. A Washington Post ABC News survey found that more than half of Americans believe the war has not made the U.S. safer. A Gallup poll also found 56% believe the war to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government was not worth the sacrifice, and 60% favor a reduction of U.S. troops deployed in Iraq. After the deaths of more than 1,700 American soldiers and news coverage of the British Downing Street memo that cast doubt on President Bush's stated justification for the war, some Democrats, as well as a handful of Republicans in Congress, are now openly calling for a timetable for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. President Bush strongly opposes such a move and reasserted in a June 28th national address his belief that there is a clear path to victory in Iraq. Over the past year, the U.S. peace movement has focused much of its energy on local organizing efforts. But anti-war groups are now planning for major protests this September in the nation's capital to give voice to the growing opposition to the war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses the goals of the anti-war actions being organized by a coalition of peace groups for September 24th through the 26th in Washington, D.C.
United for Peace and Justice, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners will recall, is the largest anti-war coalition in the country right now. We have over 1,000 member groups all around the nation. And we decided actually back at our February National Assembly that in September it would be opportune and important to have a major anti-war demonstration. As things have unfolded, we've come to realize really how important it is. What we're planning to do is to have actually 3 days of anti-war activism in Washington, D.C. We decided this time to go to the nation's capital. And we're doing this on the weekend of September 24th. That's a Saturday, Sunday the 25th of September. And then we'll invite people to stay with us over to Monday the 26th. On Saturday, we'll do a mass, and we think this will be a massive turnout of people, march and rally. We're actually thinking of not doing the same old kind of rally that usually happens at these events, but something that's much more interactive, almost like a fair, a festival of resistance, an anti-war fair. Anyway, that will be on Saturday, and we already, momentum is building, and there's a tremendous amount of interest in this, and as I said, the timing is certainly right for it. On Sunday, Sunday evening, we'll do an interfaith religious service, and again, try and pull together a large event where all the different religious orientations, will be part of the program. We also on Sunday, though, will be doing trainings for a lobby day at Capitol Hill, where people will be visiting their members of the House as well as their senators on Monday. So the training for that will be on Sunday. And also on Monday, there will be a nonviolent civil disobedience action, so the training for that will also take place on Sunday. And we're imagining that as we get closer, other activities, educational events, other protest activities will also be developed that will be part of the whole package of the weekend. Obviously, it's been important from day one that these kind of public protests happen, but there's so much, horrendous news every single day coming from Iraq. This war and the occupation continues unabated, it's really, really critical that we put the pressure on the White House and on the Congress to do everything we can to force them to stop this war. What's really interesting about the timing is that things really seem to be shifting in the country. Not only are recent public opinion polls over and over again showing a great majority, a growing majority of people in this country opposing the war and wanting it to end, but also there's cracks opening up in the Congress, in the policymaking circles in Washington. Things like the Downing Street memo that came out of London, a few weeks ago, reaffirming what we all knew, that is that the president lied about this war. So there's a whole lot that's going on that lead us to conclude that not only is it important to maintain the day-in, day-out activism that so many people are doing around the country, but that it's time in the fall, and again, we've designated the weekend of September 24th, for people from not only the East Coast, but from wherever they can travel from all around the country to come together in Washington and send that strong message.
Leslie, what's the key message or demand coming out of these days of demonstrations in September?
Well, the key demand, the central demand, is the same one that we've had from the get-go, and that is we need to end the war in Iraq and our troops need to be brought home now. That has been United for Peace and Justice's consistent demand from day one. We've never wavered from that, and we still think it's the right demand. The war, this is a war that never should have happened. It's a war, everybody, the whole world knows, this is a war that was based on lies, and that the quickest way to end this war is to end it, is to declare, is to announce that, for U.S. policymakers to announce this war is over and we're bringing our troops home. And that's, we think, the quickest road to turning things around in Iraq. In that context of that major demand, there are other demands that we'll be making. For instance, we think it's time for military recruiters to get out of our schools. We know that our communities are being bankrupted by this war. So instead of, you know, billions of dollars going into the war, we want money coming into our own communities and the programs we need funded. So there are, you know, a number of connections that we will be making through the weekend, but the core central issue here is ending the war in Iraq and bringing our troops home.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact the nationwide coalition of peace groups by calling area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. When the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, was debated and approved by the U.S. Congress in 1993, little was known about the trade treaty's effect on workers in America, Canada, and Mexico. But proponents of NAFTA promised that the agreement would boost the creation of high-paying jobs for thousands of Americans and lift millions of Mexicans out of poverty. More than 10 years later, critics of NAFTA point to data that indicates America has lost 900,000 jobs to cheap foreign labor, and 1.3 million small Mexican farmers have lost their land due to unequal competition with giant multinational agribusiness. Now, President Bush has renewed his call for Congress to ratify the controversial Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, that would eliminate trade barriers between the U.S., Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Critics fear that, like NAFTA, CAFTA could accelerate the loss of U.S. jobs, devastate small farmers, and encourage the proliferation of sweatshops. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, part of a coalition of fair trade and labor groups opposing CAFTA. He considers the winners and losers if the Bush administration should win its fight in Congress to ratify the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
CAFTA is NAFTA with a C. The fact that it rhymes is not a coincidence. It's 900 pages of text, and about 98% of it was a copy and paste from NAFTA. Congress started hearings on CAFTA a little over a month ago. It was actually an agreement that was signed by the Bush administration about 13 months ago now, and it's been sitting basically at the White House, and they haven't trotted it up Pennsylvania Avenue yet just because there's been such a lack of support just among Democrats and Republicans, because they see that 11 years now of NAFTA haven't really added up to the promises. And so there's a lot of heat on members of Congress in their home districts, and just a lot of talk more about a $660 billion trade deficit that's on the front pages more and more, and just seeing that the success of this NAFTA-style agreements around the world haven't really benefited the people that they said that they're going to be benefiting.
Chris, if the Central American Free Trade Agreement were signed into law like NAFTA was more than 10 years ago, in your view, who would the likely winners and losers be?
The likely winners would be, you know, the groups that are promoting it most, which is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I think both proponents and opponents of CAFTA see this as part of a larger battle over trade policy right now. On its merits, CAFTA represents really a very small market. It's actually, there's been a statistic that has floated around for a while that the six CAFTA countries add up to the GDP equals that of New Haven, Connecticut. And it's seen as, you know, more of a struggle over how we're going to set trade policy in the future. NAFTA, you know, a dozen years ago was, it was more theory. It was looking ahead, and no one really knew. But now, you know, we have a dozen years of results, and so the style of trade that we'll have in the future, a lot will be determined in this battle over CAFTA. For anyone that's been following this closely sees that momentum has been with the critics of this model, and that there has been a broad-based coalition of groups that are opposed to this, which includes a lot of U.S. Latino groups, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the nation's largest Latino civil rights group, a supporter of NAFTA, has been outspoken against CAFTA, which has really resonated on Capitol Hill and in the press.
Certainly, the people in Central America are some of the poorest in this hemisphere, if not the world. And many people here in this country are concerned about the loss of jobs overseas after NAFTA's passage in 1994. So when an average worker in these two regions looks at CAFTA, what do they see?
I think, you know, workers in the U.S. who are, you know, following this debate see CAFTA as just more of the same policy. In Central America, as you mentioned, yes, is a very poor countries and countries that really, with the exception of, I'd say, Costa Rica, have among the worst labor rights records in the world, and this agreement does nothing to really improve that.
So, politically speaking, what is the president and supporters of CAFTA up against in the House of Representatives in particular, where it's going to come up first?
It's funny that you say that because, you know, a group like ours that's been following this for a while and others had expected the House of Representatives to take this up first. That may not be the case. The Senate may actually vote on this even later this week. And in the Senate, it's usually a pretty free trade friendly body where it'll pass probably with some ease. But politically in the House, yeah, it's more the chamber that hears more from local folks and knows the impact of trade agreements have been in their districts. And there are about 190 Democrats that are out against this right now. Right now, there's only 5 Democrats in the House that are supportive of this publicly. And there's, you know, a chunk of 30 to 40 Republicans who are opposed to this as well. And right now we're seeing the administration really try to build some momentum for it. That gets back to why they want to bring this up in the Senate first. You know, assuming that it passes in the Senate, they'll be able to point to that as being, you know, a success, a win, and try to see how well that carries over into the House. And there's a lot of deal-making going on, of course, as this administration is proved with lots of different parts of the Republican agenda. They will not likely bring something to the floor unless they're really close and know that they can push it through, and they're known to do it in the middle of the night when no one's watching.
That was Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, part of a coalition of fair trade and labor groups opposing CAFTA. Contact the group by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Sophia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.